When I was 18, I moved out of the house and I didn't look back. I got a lot of criticism when I first came home. For a long time, I had a lot of imposter syndrome. Getting to Yale on the SAT scores, mine were the lowest in my dorm. Maybe they're gonna figure out I'm not smart enough. That kind of feeling is the imposter syndrome. My identity has really shifted in the last few years, and it's been a hard adjustment. Well, where'd you go? Why aren't you working? Well, I am working, it's just a PBS. My dad and I are super tight, but my stepfather filled in this space that I really needed at that time. When I was applying to colleges, he wrote me a check for $500, and he said, apply to everyone you want to. Don't think about it, just apply to all of them. That changed my life. A big turning point in my life, I went to Bristol ESPN to interview the youngest guy to ever win NASCAR. Been on world news and I'm riding super high. And I get back to the hotel and then I get a phone call that he was hit by a boat. They didn't know if he was going to make it. And a couple hours later, I get the call that he didn't make it. Suddenly, priorities are crystallized. When you have kids, it really makes you reflect on how you were parented. So the therapy is very helpful to contextualize, to understand, and to realize, like, I'm going to just do things differently. My mother's super critical of me still, but she has softened also with age. She's always telling me to work less now. Enjoy your life. Take time. Don't work so hard. I think that also my stepfather's death probably had that impact on her too, that you kind of realize, oh, it's so short that you better enjoy it.
Greater Good Radio, Connect, Learn, Heal, and Grow is brought to you by Brain Gain Hawaii, a boutique executive recruiting, career development, and coaching firm. Learn more at braingainhi.com.
Yunji, thank you so much for joining me today and agreeing to come on the show.
Aloha. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. So, you know, when I look at your background and I see the accomplishments, right? It's like Yale University, Berkeley, big-time journalist and reporter. If I was meeting you for the first time, like, how would you introduce yourself today?
You know, it depends on the context. I think if you're meeting me, you know, in the last 7 years since I had a child, I'm definitely more in the mom space and trying not to talk about my professional accomplishments or, you know, start off on that footing. But, you know, then there is, of course, the professional side. I guess every parent has that duality, right? Like, now I'm so-and-so's mom or dad, and now I'm so-and-so's wife. So it really depends on the context.
So if we were talking about your work, like, what do you do for work? How would you explain that?
I'm a journalist. I'm a freelance journalist, which is a new space for me. I've always worked for big companies. And then in the last 7 years after having my daughter, I've been freelance. So I work for PBS Hawaii, and now I work for Hawaii News Now. I just do weekly programs for them. I work part-time, which is super intentional for me. For many, many years, as long as I can remember, I was always trying to achieve. So whether it was academics, right? So starting in high school. So my dad started me out when I was very young. When I was 18, I moved out of the house and I didn't look back. And when you're 18, you're out.
Not usual for Hawaii.
Well, my dad's from Holland. So it is not usual, right? So he said, the expectation was that when you turned 18, you would be on your own, that you would financially have to figure it out, right? Not in a mean way, per se. I mean, it wasn't like you were going to be homeless, like, but it was this expectation that you would be independent. So I knew that I needed to have very high academic scores because my dad's a yoga teacher. My mom was a massage therapist at the Kona Village for many years. So my parents didn't have any money. They didn't set aside any kind of money for college or anything like that for me. So it was, okay, I'm going to have to do loans and I'm going to have to do scholarships. So, you know, starting from when I was very young, it was be academically hard charging. And then, you know, that worked out. And then it was, okay, now I really want to get, you know, the job that I want. So it was very work-related, hard charging, right? I always said that, like, I'm not smart. I just try to work the hardest, right? Academically, I'm okay. But it's really that I have the work ethic that I could do it. I think now, maybe not. But, you know, early years, yes. So I was able to achieve a lot of things that I wanted, you know, in my professional life. And then I had kids. And that takes you for a whole left turn that I didn't expect. I always thought that I would work and I would have, you know, a nanny or I would do daycare or whatever it is. And then you have a baby and then you go back to work and it's a very different story. Or at least it was for me. So now I'm lucky enough that I can work part-time. My husband works very hard and we're able to make it financially that I just work part-time, which in Hawaii is a huge luxury. I'm very aware of that. So my identity has really shifted in the last few years, and it's been a hard adjustment. actually. It really has. Because for so long, I was just defined as, oh, I'm this woman who's on television, right? And now, you know, you run into people in the grocery store and, oh, where'd you go? Why aren't you working? What are you doing? Well, I am working. It's just at PBS or, you know, so, but there is this expectation. People develop a relationship with you, especially, you know, I was at KITV for 5 years doing the 5, 6, and 10. So they see you in your in their living room for 5 years consistently night after night. And then it's like, oh, where did you go? Why aren't you there? So.
Was that a hard adjustment?
Really hard. Yeah. There was a lot of, who am I? What's my identity? I'm not used to being a freelancer. I'm not used to having a baby and trying to hustle this and trying to, you know, I've done a lot of freelance projects, but those, you know, you do like a show and then it goes away and then you have to find the next show. And I've never been in that position before. So that was tough for me.
So with this in mind, right, this transitionary, which is a huge transition, right? Hard charging to kind of being able to actually take a step back and right. focus on what matters. Not that the work didn't matter, but, you know, the priorities change. Can you remember a story or a memory of like a pivotal moment where it's like, oh, I need to make this adjustment?
So I had Kaya and I took 3 months off and then I went back for 3 months. And, you know, the agreement with my mom was, because she lives on Big Island, she came for those first months that I went back to work. And so I would be pumping in an office and a newsroom is open. So you don't typically have an office. They gave me an office space to pump and I'm just sitting in there. And I mean, TMI, the milk's not coming. And like I was reading online, oh, like have a blanket with the baby smell and like look at a picture. So I'm like, you know, trying to like make this happen, trying to type out the newscast, trying to like be engaged in too many things at the same time. And it was like, why am I doing this? Right? No one's re-racking the tape. When the news is done, no one like rewinds it and says, oh, I'm going to watch that newscast again. It was so good. Nobody, you know, you are the background to someone folding laundry, really. That's, you know, unless it's a really significant story. Something that's happening, like what's happening in Lahaina, people are paying attention. But for the most part, day to day, you're not a really, I feel, this is my interpretation, I don't feel like you're a significant impact in the way that makes it worth it to sit there and smell that baby blanket and not be with the actual child. So that really was kind of like a moment for me. And so after 3 months, I left. But then you leave and suddenly, and I've never not worked, right? From when I was, you know, as soon as I was of age to work, I had a part-time job, like high school all the way through, right? And even before that, I did babysitting, I did whatever. And so then to suddenly go to zero and then, you know, this expectation, well, where did you go? Well, what are you doing? And I would hate that. In the very beginning, it was really hard because, you know, you go out to Long's or whatever and it's like, oh, what are you doing now? And it's like, well, I'm doing this. This is my daughter, right? And so, but that's also like a weird cover. Like, I don't have to explain it to anyone. But it took a long time to figure out, like, what's the appropriate answer? Or maybe you don't have to answer, right? But people are naturally curious. We're a small community. They want to know, oh, what happened to so-and-so? This is not unique to me. It's to anyone who's in that profession. So the question is well-intended. And, you know, that's not like a mean thing. But I would receive it as like some kind of interrogation or like judgment on what I had chosen to do.
So how are you dealing with judgment? Because, you know, being on TV, you're heavily judged.
Especially now, right? Social media.
Yeah.
So I started my career in New Orleans and I didn't know that community. So it's okay, right? So it was 2 years there. And then I went to ABC and I worked for ABC for 6 years. And then you're on a national scale. So it doesn't matter because, you know, I mean, people might say bad things about it. And Twitter actually came out while I was working at the White House. And so that's when I got that first taste of like, oh, she's a hack or she's this or whatever. You get that first kind of interaction. But social media was just sort of starting to become part of the conversation at that point. And then I came home and the relationship is way more intimate with the audience because it is the people in your community. So you have a way bigger responsibility and people take you to task. And when I came home, so I left Hawaii when I was 14. I went to high school in the mainland. And I didn't remember like how to pronounce Hawaiian words. And I grew up on Big Island. So I came back and I remember I drove around with a friend. We drove around the island and he's like, those are the ko'olau's. This is the, right? And like, I don't know those things. I grew up on another island in a small town. Like, it wasn't part of my experience. When I was very young, we grew up here, but I moved when I was five. So coming here for like school shopping trips, right? I remember we came, we saw Phantom of the Opera at the Blaisdell. It was like a big deal. We stayed at the Ala Moana Hotel. So that's my experience of Oahu. And then now suddenly I'm required to report on this community. And so the words did not come easily. If you go back and watch those early newscasts, which of course no one does, but if you did, you can hear me like really struggling to get my mouth around all those vowels. Like I just didn't have it. And so I was very insecure about coming home and kind of being local, but not being local enough, right? And not having gone to high school here. And that's a big thing, right? That's a big part of the narrative of who you are when you're part of Hawaii. So I felt like I got a lot of criticism when I first came home. And people would write the station and you'd get emails and they go to the whole newsroom. Why can't she say this? I don't like her lipstick. I don't like her hair. Who is this person, right? And I think what people don't realize is that goes to everyone you work with and it goes to your boss. And it just erodes your self-confidence. So what I always would do is I would write the person back directly. Hi, thank you so much for the feedback. I really appreciate that you're watching. And then they would write you back and they say, oh, I didn't realize anyone read this. I had no idea. We think you're great. We watch you every night. My husband loves you. And it's like, so this person who would never say that to your face suddenly is like called to task. I'm just lucky that I got out before it got real bad because
it's like trolling before trolling.
Right. Yeah. Just send an
it's like
email.
Old school trolling.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think criticism, you know, everybody deals with that. But when you're in that kind of public space, you kind of sign up for it. I don't think that when I started, because there was no social media, that I realized as much like how much of part of the job that becomes. But I'm more aware of it now.
So what's another story that you can think of that showed how the judgment was affecting you and then how you dealt with it?
There was this one person who would criticize me a lot, right? This older, like, local woman who would either write the station or comment on the Facebook page that she, like, did not like my work, right? Which is fine. She doesn't have to watch. That's her choice. And so then I Googled her because I was curious, like, who is this person? And I see that she's in all these advertisements for her union. She's a union worker. So then I like make this connection and then I see her like, I don't remember, at the mall or something. And I just remember looking at her and thinking like, would you say that to my face? Like, here I am. Like, are you going to come talk to me and levy all this? And of course not. Of course not. Right? And I make eye contact. I know she sees me. She's written all this stuff. She knows who I am. Right. So in that circumstance, you just have to swallow it, breathe. You don't know what happens in that person's life. You don't know why they've decided that that's worth their time. And you just move on.
So she never like, acknowledged you at all?
No, 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 no.
Like when you make eye contact, it's not like, oh, hi, or something like
that. No.
Or smile, yeah,
no,
or
no,
something.
No. There was that. There was a definite recognition. But there's no follow up. Of course not.
That's such an interesting one to me, though, because there's a saying that, you know, perception is projection, right? We project externally what we feel internally. So if I feel that the world is dangerous, then all I see is danger, right? If I feel like the world is loving, all I see is love, right? A good example would be I surf out there and then it's always the guys that are like, oh my God, so-and-so is going to be dropping in on us. They don't know how, you know, they're always taking the waves. And that's always the person that does it, right? Mm-hmm. So we'll look at somebody else and judge something in them that we don't like in ourselves. We just do it externally. So on something like that, it's interesting because it's like what kind of triggered her in you that she didn't like about herself.
Right.
And then being able to look at it that way, because it's hard a lot of times, right, to step back and look at it that way. But when we can look at it that way, I mean, it's not me.
Right.
I mean, it might be me. Like if I'm doing something like totally, you know, I'm irresponsible or something dangerous or whatever, but a lot of times it's not.
It might not be. I mean, I remember, this is like embarrassing to reveal, but I remember one person wrote in one time, and this is right when I started. And I had always been a reporter with a little bit of fill-in anchoring experience, but at the network, they don't really let you fill in that much, right? So I would fill in on the overnight. So it was my first time being like a full-fledged anchor. And I remember this person wrote in and said, oh, we love watching because we love to count how many times she makes a mistake. That is so mean. Think about that. Like, right? I can imagine doing that with my family, right? Oh, this person, they're really bad. Let's watch. But I can't imagine taking the time to sit down and write that down and send it to the person. Like, that was very painful for me. Mm-hmm. And I took it really personally. And then I made a real concerted effort to be better. So maybe that person made me better, right? Mm-hmm. Made me a stronger newsreader, made me, you know, read the copy three times instead of twice so that I wouldn't make so many mistakes, so that her count would be low. But that's kind of cruel, don't you think?
Yeah. It's hard not to take it personally, right?
Well, I mean, what is that? That is personal.
Right? It's personal. Right? And when you think about that, though, and you go, okay, well, what does this person feel at that time that they're sitting there watching for mistakes in somebody else? Like, what emotion?
As a family.
Yeah, what emotions are they feeling together?
They're feeling better about themselves.
But what is the core emotion? Like, the initial, like,
envy, I would think.
Could be shame. Hmm. Which is like, I'm bad, something's wrong with me. Could be things like that, right?
To me, it's the same reason why people watch, like, Hoarders or My 600-Pound Life,
yeah,
right? All these shows that, you know, inherently you judge, right? You're judging that person and you're mm-hmm. judging them against yourselves. I mean, for better or worse, that's what those shows are. That's the core of the design, yeah, right? Which is a pretty messed up sort of paradigm, right? And it's kind of the same, mm-hmm. except for when I was doing my work, that was not the intention of what I was putting out. So that's really painful, right? I'm not out there to, you know, I'm not supposed to be the story. I'm just supposed to deliver the story. So yeah, that was tough. I'm really happy not to be in that anymore. I mean, I'm still in television, but the work that I do now, I like it a lot better. I enjoy doing an evening newscast, but the timing wasn't right for me, right? So I work 2 p.m. to 11 p.m. So for a new mom, it's okay. You're with the baby in the morning, and then my mom would take care in the afternoon. My husband comes home at night. But as your kids get older, it's just untenable for me. I mean, there are plenty of women I know who work in news, and that schedule works for them. It didn't work for me. Now what I do, like, I try to limit my work to school hours, except for, you know, PBS is at night. But most of the background work I do is at home, you know, during the day when my kids are at school. And then one night a week, Kent watches. So that's fine. It's just one night not being there. I have a friend who works at a network, and I remember she had posted on social media, so glad I'm home for the rare bedtime story, right? But this is not judgment on her, right? That's what she's chosen to do in life. But I remember thinking, like, I'm so lucky because that's not a luxury. That's every day, right? And so that trade-off is worth it for me.
The interesting thing, though, on that trade-off to me is that you can make it mentally and emotionally. Because a lot of the people that I talk to that are Ivy League type or so on, I mean, you have to have, and I don't have to tell you this, some incredible drive to accomplish that. You have to be able to sacrifice things. You have to be able to push through things. I'm not saying it's you, but a lot of times when the people that I'm dealing with in that kind of area are driven heavily by, like, fear and pain. Mm. Like shame, like, I'm going to show them that I am something. I will not be, you know, I am not defective. I'm going to show you in a real and meaningful way,
right,
that this is me. Mm. And then they push through that, but they can't turn it off. You know what, right, I mean? It's been pushed through, and they're like, you know, my age, 50, and it's like, they can't stop, and they have more money than they know what to do with. They have more other things. Things are maybe falling apart or not, but they can't stop.
Well, a big turning point in my life, and it's the reason I came home, is because my stepfather died, and he was 53. He was a COO for a Bay Area tech company. He worked in artificial intelligence before it was cool. Like, he was one of the first folks who was doing that kind of work. This is in the 90s and then into the 2000s. And he had the day off. He worked remotely, and he went swimming off Mahukona, which is along the Kohala Coast. There's no beach there, and he was swimming in very deep water. No flag, and he got hit by a boat. And it's just, if you know that area, like the chance of that happening is so small, right? Because you're one person in this huge ocean. And, you know, this it was aquarium fisherman. So he was going out there to catch fish along the reef. So he was close to the shoreline. And my stepfather hugged the shoreline when he swam. But he didn't swim with the flag, which is, a fatal mistake in this case. So he got hit by a boat and he was 53 and he died. And I was working for Good Morning America at the time. And I remember I was on a story. They'd flown me up to New York. I went to Bristol ESPN to interview the youngest guy to ever win NASCAR. It was like a big deal. He was like in his 20s. And I'm coming back in like a black town car. And I'm, I'd been on world news and I'm just like feeling like I'm the shit, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm going to go stay in this fancy hotel. And then I'm going to go, go to do Good Morning America the next day. And like, this is like, I'm riding super high. And I get back to the hotel and then I get a phone call that he was hit by a boat and that they didn't know if he was going to make it. And a couple hours later, I get the call that he didn't make it. And then I'm in New York and I fly back to Kona, which takes forever. in that moment, and I just cried the whole plane ride. And I think that happening, for our whole family, it was just, your world is turned upside down, right? He leaves to go on a swim and he never comes back. I think if you have something like that happen, suddenly priorities are crystallized. And then when I have my own daughter, a number of years later, it's like, again, it's that same kind of feeling where you're sitting in that office with the baby blanket and the picture trying to get the milk to come out. And it's like, oh, this is totally not in tune with who I am and what I need to be doing in this moment, right? So at that point, when my stepdad died, my mom was super lost. She'd married him. She'd given up her business. She'd become a housewife. She didn't know how much money he made. She didn't know how the bills were paid. She was just like living her best life in Javi, just, having a good time being with him. And she had been gardening that day. Like that's the life that she was living. So I came home, I stayed for a month. I sorted out all the finances, figured out how she could keep the house and live and, have income coming in and all of that. And then I tried to figure out, okay, how do I get closer to Hawaii? How do I get closer to Hawaii? And it had happened because Obama was the president. He would come home every year for a month for Christmas. And at that point, I was assigned to Atlanta. I covered the Southeast. So I wasn't at the White House anymore. But because no one actually at the network wants to come when the president comes because they don't get to be with their family. But for me, it was like, so I kept coming even when I wasn't a White House correspondent anymore. And so I happened to be home and I said, someday I want to come home. And they were like, okay, how about now? And so then like this path opened up and I came back. And even at the time, my attorney / agent, was like, what are you doing? What are you doing? Why would you go back? Honolulu is market like 73, TV markets are ranked. You're working at the network. You were a White House correspondent. You cover the entire Southeast. So my responsibility was the edge of Texas to Florida to North Carolina, 13 states, right? I was traveling constantly. I was doing more television than I ever dreamed I would do. And it was like, no, I got to go back. I got to go back, And so I did. I was engaged to someone else at the time. That's another story. And he didn't want to come back. So we broke up and that was hard. So then I had moved home. I was in my early 30s. I think I was 33 or 34 at the time. Yeah. And I had had this what felt like whole lifetime. And then I came back and I always wanted to come back. Like that was part of my plan. But my plan was, when I'm 50, I'll come back and I'll ride out retirement and anchor the news. Like that'll be fun. And then he died and everything kind of crystallized.
So do you regret that at all coming back at that time?
No, not at all. I married the right person, not the wrong person. The person that I was with is a beautiful person. I respect him very much. I have a lot of love for him. He just wasn't the right person for me. And I came home and a year later, I went on a blind date and I met Kent, my husband. And, third date, he was like, I want to marry you. I was like, whoa, it's kind of early, but okay. I'm not okay, we'll get married, but okay, let's see where this goes. Within 6 months, we were engaged. A year later, we were married. So a year after a meeting, we got married.
That sounds kind of bold coming from Kent because he don't say a whole lot.
Yeah, from people who don't know him, he's kind of a quiet, and he's, he went to Harvard. He's like a smart, methodical person. He's the opposite of me. I'm very impulsive. He's not. He's careful. So I didn't know that then. Mm-hmm. Just thought he was like kind of a weirdo. Like, who says that? You just met, right?
You've never had somebody say that to you before?
No. Oh. No way. Mm. Yeah. Have you said that to someone before?
I don't think so.
That quick is like kind of too quick. But it was...
I was just asking that because, you know, you're in the limelight. You're, you know, super attractive and so on. And then maybe some dudes would say that. I don't know. That's what I was curious.
No, definitely not. Yeah.
You know, it's funny. I took my son, my oldest son, to go meet Kent because he's in finance. My son is into finance, right? So I said, you know, Kent went to Harvard and this and that. I said, oh, so you must have had like the really high SAT. He goes, oh, yeah, pretty good or something. And and I said, oh, so you had like the highest in your class? He goes, yeah, something like that. And then it ends up being like the highest in the state.
Right. He's
right?
The math champion of the whole state.
Yeah, he didn't say the whole math champion part, but he was like, oh, it's actually the whole state. And I was like, oh. Because he doesn't say a lot. Like, no. he's not boastful. He's very humble.
So humble.
Yeah. Yeah. So how did that blind date thing work out? What's the story behind that?
Okay, so this girl that I went to college with, she had moved back because she married his Harvard classmate. So this girl that I went to Yale with married this Harvard guy. And I moved to Oahu. And like I said, I'd grown up on Big Island. The friends that I had from small kid time were still there. No one was here. So I didn't know anybody. So my girlfriend Grace was the only person that I knew on Oahu. And so she was very kind. She integrated me into her friend group. I immediately had a bunch of girlfriends. And like a little less than a year after, she was like, oh, there's this guy. He's Mark's classmate. You should meet him. But, you know, and I was like, okay. Because I had, before that, I was engaged, right? I'd been with the same guy for 7 years. So we met in my mid-20s, and then I come back here. So I missed all that dating. I didn't know how to date. Like, I went on the apps, like I did, like, eHarmony and some of the apps, and I was not having much luck. And I worked nights, so I really had, like, limited time.
What does that mean, not much luck?
The matches were just not right.
Oh.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, it was fine. And I wasn't good at it. Like, I'm not a good casual dater. Like, I'm good in a relationship, but I'm not good at just, hi, good to meet you. Like, I'll see you later. Like, I immediately want to be like, here's my whole heart. Like, let's be together, right? Maybe not let's get married on the third date, but, you know, close to it. And so I wasn't good at that kind of casual, like, figuring that out. So anyway, so when she suggested that we do a blind date, I was like, yeah, great. Sure. And then we went to dinner and we talked for a long time. And I remember like really liking him, but he only eats one meal a day. He did intermittent fasting before that was a thing. And I was like, that's weird. Like, who does that? And he was a wrestler in high school. So that's why he does that, to cut weight. And he just like stuck. But I was like, you know, food is one of the great pleasures of life. Like, do you deprive yourself? Like, if you deprive yourself in this arena, what are you like in other arenas? You know, like, are you super tight with money? Are you super tight with just like pleasure in general? Right. And that's not who I am. I'm the opposite. Like, I'm just like, oh, let's go do this. Let's do that. Oh, who cares how much it costs? Like, let's go have fun. Right. Which is why I'm the one who ends up with like taking the kids to Shave Ice or the Fun Factory or Carnival, whatever. Like, my husband doesn't want to, you know, he's counting the tickets. Right. Anyway. So that was actually like a hesitation for me because I was like, oh, he only eats one meal a day. Like, he must be no fun. The adaptation is that when we go on vacation, he'll at least accompany us to other meals.
So when was it that you knew you were in love?
Pretty quick. Yeah. I would say, I mean, around that third date time, I was like, oh, this is getting serious. And then a couple months later, he moved into my place. And my mom was like, what? Like, because I wanted to buy a house, so he rented out his place so we could pool our money. And we were starting to talk about buying a house together. We're, like, not engaged. Like, she's like, what is happening? You know, like, my mom is old school Korean. She's like, who's this guy? And why is he living with you? Why aren't you living with him? You know? But anyway, for leasing and other reasons, he moved in with me. So it was pretty quick, a couple months in.
Do you remember, like, a story around that? Or
I mean, like, falling in love is so beautiful, right? It's just that beginning time and just feeling like free and that you can be really be yourself with someone. And I loved that he is so different. He didn't watch the news. That was the other thing that was weird about being on the apps, because they would be like, oh, I watch you on TV. And I'm like, oh, well, then we're not going out. Like, which is not that person's fault, right? That just like happens to be like my industry. But he is very secure in who he is. and he's very honest. And I just felt like, oh, I can really trust this person. And this is a good person. Mm-hmm. So that's why that happened.
I'm so curious on this app, dating app piece. I mean, I've never done it because I've been married and
right,
so for
right.
so long.
Right, right. If you're of a certain age and you missed it.
But
thank
the thing
this.
That you're kind of famous locally, right? And so how does that even work? Like you go on there and how do you know people are trying to, you know, meet you for you or something? You know what I mean? I would have all these things going on in my head.
I don't know. It was really like tricky, but I didn't feel like I had a choice, right? Because I worked 5 nights a week. So I only had Saturday night to go out. I'm not like a big bar person. I mean, I'll have a drink or whatever, but that seemed like a weird way. And my network was small. I had my girlfriend, Grace, and then like some of her friends. Most of them were married, right? So it was like, this is the most efficient way to do this. And by the way, I'm like 33, TikTok on the baby thing, like gonna do this. So that's why. But I did have some hesitation. And like on that whole TV thing, when I was newly single. Like, I didn't really know. I mean, not to make myself sound like Pollyanna-ish, but I just was not, I didn't know how to navigate this, right? So someone wrote to me at the station. It's like, oh, I really like the story that you did on XYZ, right? And this is via Facebook, though. This is my public Facebook page. And I see his picture, and he's, like, kind of cute. So I'm, like, writing, well, thank you for writing back. And then we start this, like, correspondence, right? Kent's going to hate that I told this story. So then he like asks to meet up. So I'm like, oh, this seems like a bad idea. Like this is weird. But I'm like, whatever. Like, you know, this is my workplace. So this is how I'm meeting someone, right? I like justify it. So we go out, we go to House Without a Key, right? Go listen to some music, watch the sunset. We're talking. And then it turns out he's married. So it was like, every fear that, like, oh, I can't trust, like, anything. Like, who is this? Who does that? Anyway, such a small town. If he's watching, he knows who he is, but I will not reveal it. But he's like, oh, I'm going to get a divorce soon. Years later, I'm, like, house hunting with my husband. After we have our baby, we, like, are still looking at houses and stuff. And I run into him and his wife. Oh, hi. Right? I've never met his wife, but he like obviously had acknowledged that he knew me. And I see him in the community once in a while. We're not friends or anything, but it's such a weird thing. Like, who does that?
So it was on the first date that you found that out?
Yeah. So luckily he revealed that then.
How does it come out? Like, what's the conversation like?
I remember I like asked him something. I can't believe I'm telling you this. I asked him something about his like relationship. Like his last relationship or something. And he's like, well, actually, I'm married. And I was like, well, then what is this? Right? And I felt like, screw you. Like, I took a risk, right? It was such a dumb thing to kind of follow that thread and to go out with somebody who had, like, essentially seen you on television, written you, and then, like, you go out. Who does? You should not do that. That's not a trustworthy person. But I was like, you know, I mean, it's not a known quantity, so you shouldn't do that. That's like a dumb thing to do. But I did it anyway. And then like I got real burned. So dating was hard. So when I met Kent and he was very trustworthy and he was a good guy and I, you know, had some intel on him because my friend's husband had gone to college with him. And also he's just who he is. That was a lucky break for me.
I have friends that are on like even like LinkedIn. And like they're women and they're like, dude, the guys hit on us on LinkedIn.
Yeah.
It's like, wow, that's an interesting
that's
one.
That's kind of a bold one. I don't think, you know.
It's like, oh, that's.
That's the workplace is extended now, right? So.
Yeah. So weird. That is weird.
Don't you feel lucky though? Like I feel very lucky.
Dude, I'm super lucky.
To be married and to be done with that part.
I'm just lucky that. I have my wife that is my actual, you know,
your person is the person
she's
they are.
Amazing. And everyone is always like, dude, you hit the jackpot. I don't know, you know, my God.
What you did. Right. Yeah.
And they're right. And I think too, is like, I don't know. I know I live pretty privileged. I don't know what else to say. Yeah. I take it.
Well, recognizing and having gratitude is really important. So
yeah,
that's good.
So as you were growing up, did you always have everything together? I mean, your schooling, you got good grades, you were pretty? Were you athletic? You played like five instruments. I mean, what is it? You're also like an equestrian trainer. Is that
no,
how it
I'm
goes?
A drama dork all the way. I did all the plays. Mm. You know, I always like wanted to be, I thought I wanted to be an actress when I was young. So I was always wanting to be on stage and, you know, did some commercials when I was younger and did some Magnum PI when we lived here on Oahu. And then my dad was always super interested in politics. So PBS NewsHour was on in the house and NPR was on in the car. And my dad, you know, I mentioned my dad's from Holland, super politically engaged, very globally engaged, wanting the same from me. And so even to this day, that's a lot of how we relate. A lot of how we relate is like, oh, did you see what the president did? And my he'll call me up and he'll say, Yeon Jin-jin is at the round table. Like, what do you think of last night's debate? That's a lot of how we bond. And it was how we bonded. You know, some kids, like, they'll bond with their dad over baseball. Like, ours was always national politics. So I was an American government major in undergrad, studied political science. And it's really because of that. Like, you know, we're talking about like the Israeli-Palestinian conflict when I'm like 10, right? I remember the night Michael Dukakis lost. My dad's a Democrat. When Dukakis lost, I remember crying because like it was the first election that I can remember being actually aware of. And also like I remember being so sad because he was going to be so sad, right? Not that I had any skin in the game on that one, right? But just always growing up and really being engaged on those issues and then deciding that I wanted to be a journalist pretty early on.
Did you love it for what it was or just because it made you feel connected?
I mean, I think initially it's because I wanted to feel connected. And then, you know, my parents are both immigrants. My mom's from South Korea. My dad's from Holland. And, you know, the American system, for all its flaws, is fascinating. Our founding fathers and that whole story is incredible, you know, coming together and forming a government with certain intentions and ideals, which are flawed inherently because they exclude a lot of people, right? So not to like sort of paint the founders in this wonderful light, but when you think about being able to be a part of that and that history being so recent and so tangible, you can reach it, you know, you can go to those places, right? And so, and kind of feel that connection. So that was just so fascinating to me that our system of government is so unique. That ideal, you know, I kind of love it. And so I loved covering it. I loved studying it. Like, I'm still really fascinated with it.
So what are some things that people assume about you that's completely not true?
Oh, they assume I'm from Oahu. I'm from the Big Island. That I went to high school here. I went to high school on the mainland. I don't know. What do you tell me? What do people assume about me? I'm not sure.
It's more like on the exterior. If you look at Yeonji Denise, right? You're like up here. You know,
I don't think so.
No, but to an extent, right? It's like if you look at it from kind of a, I would say, average person perspective. It's like look at this person. Top tier schools. Great marriage, husband's handsome, you know, on TV. So.
Well,
handsome.
You know like, yeah. But here's the thing.
And all these things, and they're like, assume like, oh, she must have it all. And
then it's like, a hot mess express. Like, come on.
Right. But they don't know that. So that's the kind of what I'm
wondering.
So for
me, it's like duck on water, right? You know that analogy that like the duck is cruising along and looking like everything's going well. And underneath, they're just furiously paddling. It does feel like that, but you know, since transitioning to working part-time and really focusing on my family, there's less of a disconnect. That feels way better. I feel like I'm in the most authentic space in my life that I've ever been. You know, television comes with a lot of facade. I remember when I first started out, so my first job is in New Orleans, and I was making no money. My first contract, I think it was $18,000 for the year. Is that right? I can't remember. Anyway, it was not a lot. I was bouncing a lot of checks. Let's just put it that way. And my car broke down and I didn't have a car. I remember my mom like sending me her old car from Hawaii so that she could buy a new car and then giving me her car. But, you know, anyway, all of that is to say, I was at like a TJ Maxx, like shopping the discount rack, trying to find suitable clothing for being on television. And I remember running into this like a woman. She says, oh, I see you on TV. You look a lot more natural in person, you know, no makeup, whatever, right? And so there is this like disconnect. Like here I am, like bargain basement, going Goodwill and trying to like look professional when really like I'm broke and like I'm bouncing checks and I'm just trying to figure out like, you know, you're just trying to stay one step ahead. And that kind of like eases itself because that aspect, right? Because then I go to the network and I'm, you know, making a little bit more money and kind of figuring things out. So there's more stability. But I think, I'm sure everyone feels like this, but for me, like for a long time, I had a lot of imposter syndrome. You know, neither of my parents went to college. We grew up pretty humble. My parents are divorced. And there's a lot, I don't know if it's, there's not necessarily like shame in growing up with no money, but it's when you go to a place like Yale, you encounter a lot of people with a lot of money. And even my high school, you know, I went to a prep school in San Francisco, which was a huge stretch for my parents, and just feeling like this kind of need to keep up with the Joneses. And then I choose a profession where like you are the Joneses, right? Like you're supposed to present in a certain way. So yeah, I remember when I left, this is a very meandering answer, so I'm sorry for that. But when I left KITV and, you know, a couple months in, and this would happen, like I would do a big project and then the project would be over. And I would go to Kent and I'd say, I don't know what I'm doing with my life. Like, I'm such a mess. Like, I've like ruined everything. Like, what am I going to do? And he would always be like, you're killing it. He's like, nobody thinks these things about you. Like, you're doing just great. Like, you have just what you ticked off. You have this beautiful family. Like, you have all this time to be with them. You do. But it took a long time for me to be like, those things are true and I can still feel this way. Right. And those things can exist at the same time.
Is it okay for those to exist at the same time?
I think so. I think everybody's insecure to some extent, right? We're all just trying to make it. Social media makes that way worse. Instagram and all that makes that a lot worse. I find that when I take a break from that stuff, I'm so much better off like mentally. But then, you know, the algorithm is too strong. It pulls me back.
Yeah. When you say imposter syndrome, how would you define that?
Like getting to Yale and feeling like on the SAT scores, mine were not the highest in the state. Mine were the lowest in my dorm. And I know that because like first week, I mean, I love Yale, but like there's a lot of things that are really lame about being around people who are that high achieving. And one of them is I remember like first week we're sitting around in someone's dorm room and everybody decides to say like what their scores were. Why does that matter? Like, we're all here now. Who cares? I mean, I say that because mine were I didn't even say it. Mine were the lowest, right? They were high enough to get in, but the lowest among that cohort. And I went to kind of a liberal prep school. We didn't have multiple choice tests, right? And the way they did test taking was very different and grades were very different. And so I had the lowest grades, you know, in my academic life that first semester because I didn't know how to take those tests. And I remember we had finals week and the week before they give you like a study week. And the first morning I like walk by the library and there are lines of kids outside to like go inside and snag a spot to like get a library, like get a desk in the library. I was like, these people are such nerds. Like, what's that all about? But then I get the lowest scores, right? So just feeling, oh, maybe they're going to figure out I'm not smart enough. Right? That kind of feeling is the imposter syndrome. And then like coming home and then not being able to read the words and then getting an email from a viewer saying like, oh, we're tracking how many times she messes up, right? Oh, they figured it out. They figured it out. But now I feel like there's not that much to figure out because like I'm trying so much less. And I don't know that you ever stop that, but I'm trying so much less to be something that I'm not. Do you know what I mean?
How are you doing that?
Well, because you have to figure out what your priorities are, right? And so, like, I got to get food cooked and kids to school. And my kids don't give a shit about any of that stuff, right? Like, they don't care at all. So I think the most humbling experience you can have is having children because they will just knock you to your knees, right? They just want you to be with them in the moment. They want your attention. None of that other stuff matters. So that I think that that is part of it.
So that reinforced it for you enough that you can kind of move through it smoothly?
I think so. And also it's like having a daughter is part of that too. Like I remember this was a while ago, but I was getting ready to go out and my daughter was like, Mommy, why do you always wear makeup? You don't need to wear makeup. Why do you always wear makeup? You know? And at the time she's like, I don't know, 4 or 5. And I'm thinking like, you know, that's a really good question. Like, I don't know. Because when I run into someone in a grocery store, I don't want them to say like, oh, you look so natural, right? Which is code for like, oh, you look nothing like I thought you would look, right? That's another part of being in the profession that I'm in where people feel like an ownership of you in a way, and they feel like they can say something. Oh, you look so much more X than I thought you would, right? You are so much more whatever, fill in the blank, than I thought would be. I don't want to have that much of a disconnect.
So is it kind of a good thing that you're not on the news every night then, because you don't have that constant like comparison?
Yeah, for myself, yeah. For my mental health, I think it's better. And I would like the work that I'm doing now, which is kind of similar to the work that you're doing, right? These deep interviews where you try to really get beyond the soundbite and try to get to the heart of what's happening. That's much more authentic to the work I want to be doing than, you know, there's a place, obviously, to anchoring a newscast. It's just not my place anymore.
You know, when you said authenticity, like, how are you defining authenticity?
I'm not trying to be something that you're not or present something that you're not, right? I don't want there to be that otherness, right? Oh, that's the woman from X. And we do that with whoever, like, oh, that's the president of this bank. Like, I must interact in a certain way, or that's the head of this company, or that's the head of this school, whatever, you know, pick your profession, right? And people relate a certain way when that person is obviously just a person, right? So I don't want that kind of distance and space.
Is there a story you can share that really would illustrate when you felt truly authentic?
I mean, I think I'm trying to live that way. I don't know that there's like, I just feel so much more comfortable. It used to really bother me when people would say, what are you doing now? How come I don't see you on TV? What are you up to? You know, and feeling like I had to explain myself. Well, I'm actually doing this, and I'm working harder than ever, and these are all the things. And by the way, I have these two beautiful, I don't feel the need to explain anymore. And so the answer to that question is, oh, I'm at PBS, or I'm doing something at Hawaii News Now, or it's nothing. It's like, oh, I've been busy, you know, like I don't have to tell you, right? And it's not even about that person. That person's not doing anything wrong. It's about me like justifying it to myself. But it goes back to what, you know, the story about my stepfather, right? That one day to the next, you can be swimming and doing something you love and be hit by a boat and be dead, right? So why do I have to like fill in that space? Just be who you are. But it takes a long time to get there.
So with your stepfather, could you share a story that would illustrate like who he was?
Oh God, he's so great. I'm very close to my dad. My dad and I are super tight. But my stepfather kind of filled in this space that I really needed at that time. So they got together when I was a sophomore in high school. And he's a tech entrepreneur. And he had gone to college. And, you know, he was a business professional and very smart, really smart. And when I was applying to colleges, you know, I think I told you, like, I was very stressed out. And I remember all the applications were $50. The fees were $50. And I was using all my babysitting money for that to apply to college. And I remember he wrote me a check for $500. And he said, apply to everyone you want to. Don't think about it. Just apply to all of them. That is such a gift, right? That changed my life. Because I just was like, okay, I don't have to think about prioritizing this or that. Like, I'm just going to apply to all of them. So I ended up applying to 10 schools. I spent $600. And Yale wasn't my first choice. I wanted to go to Wellesley because being like the political, you know, interest that I had, Madeleine Albright and Hillary Clinton had both gone to Wellesley, and which is a women's college in Massachusetts. And I just thought like, I thought the world of both of them. You know, they were really at the time very high achieving, kind of the highest achieving women in that space at the time. So if they went there, I was going to try to go there. And so I don't know if I would have applied to Yale. I probably wouldn't have spent the $50. You know, I was making $5 an hour as a babysitter, 10 hours of work. I mean, that's just like a very generous spirit. And he was just such a good person. He was a Republican. He's, like I said, very different from my dad. We would argue about politics all the time. He loved my mom in like the most wholehearted, authentic way, right? And he was just, I mean, just magnanimous is the word that I think of, just like a big heart.
So you said that he loved your mom in a deep way. Mm-hmm. What, can you share a story about that, that would encompass that?
He was just very accepting. I don't know, older Korean women are tough, right? And he was this holly guy who could just, whatever she wants to do, that's fine. You know, just be who you are, you don't have to worry about anything. Like, I'll take care of it, you know. And so.
Sounds like Kent.
Very much. I think so. My mom always says, oh, they would have really loved each other. Same kind of humility, same kind of energy.
So she wasn't married to him for that long before he passed.
So I want to say like 15 years, something like that. Yeah, not enough.
What was the kind of key point in your mom's kind of recovery from that, or even yours, the passing?
So I stayed for that month and kind of got her stable. This is how you do online banking. This is how you pay property tax. Like, these are all the basics, right? She knew all those things inside. She'd been a business owner. She just hadn't done that for 15, 16 years, right?
Plus in the shock of
and yeah, right? And all that. And then she just wasn't eating. Like, I would just be like, have a bowl of rice, like eat something, right? And I was in Atlanta at the time. I was engaged to someone else. I was like living my life. And it was like, oh, I gotta get home. And I just felt like she was like comatose, like catatonic, like just like in a haze. And I just knew that I had to get as close as possible. And so that's why I moved home. It was like, whatever. And I think that coming home, she would watch the news every night. Then I would go to Javi a lot. I would go to the Big Island a lot, or she would come here a lot. And that kind of brought her out. But she really says it wasn't until I had the babies that she was like, really felt like she could focus her energy somewhere else.
So did you feel like you had to have babies?
No. Oh. It was like once that happened, she says like her spirit reawakened.
So your mom sounds like a firecracker.
Oh my gosh.
What's a memory you have of her that would, you know, show us kind of who your mom is?
When I was growing up, like, it was the kind of thing where like, don't show me a report card, right? Unless it's all A's, right? I don't want to see it. I want to know why this is an A minus. And I remember being in the eighth grade and making honor roll. My last name is Denise, so it starts with a D. And there was a boy whose last name was Bartholomew, so he was above it. And so the honor roll comes home with the grades, and she's looking at it, and she's like, why aren't you at the top? And I said, well, it's an alphabetical order, so I'm not going to be at the top. Well, can't you do some extra credit? Surely there must be something. You know, and not accepting that, like, no, this is alphabetical order. There's nothing I can change. And her being like frustrated with that system, right? That surely do some extra homework. Every summer when school would get out, she'd go to the teacher and say, can you give Yanji some homework for the summer? And they would say, oh, no, we don't do it. They have a good summer, whatever. When I was young, I had this children's dictionary. Every day she would make me sit there and copy pages out of the... That's how they learned in Korea, right? So that was how she knew. She didn't know, like, there's no project-based learning. Like,
Korean schools are hardcore.
Hardcore, right? Like. And after school and late night and all that. So she would have me copy the dictionary, right, as my, like, homework. When I was young, I wasn't allowed to watch a lot of TV in the house. And then... finally she would relent. She would make me watch the TV with the sound off to activate my brain so I could imagine what the characters were saying. And I would try to explain to her how frustrating that was, because if you're imagining what they're saying, you can't anticipate what they're going to do. So you're just trying to imagine what was done. It's like watching TV on mute as a child is like a special kind of torture. That kind of gives you like a sense, right? It was very hard charging. It was difficult. I mean, it's taken a long time. I've been in therapy since we were trying to conceive. So 8 years now, every week. It's the best thing, changed my life. And a lot of that is, how do I parent? How's it going to be different? How do I forgive? And I think when you have, you know, my parents had me young and they made the choices that they made. And my choices are different.
How young?
So my mom was 21 and my dad was 23, so young. And for context, when I had my daughter, I was 38 and I had felt like I'd lived this whole lifetime. I'd gone to undergrad, graduate school, had these jobs, made this money. I mean, I was in a much better financial position, like all of the things, right? They did the best they could with the circumstances they had. But it's interesting, I think, when you have kids, it really makes you reflect on how you were parented. Because as my kids reach certain milestones, oh, they're five. Oh, this is when my parents got divorced. Oh, they're this. Like, this is when, like, whatever it is, whatever trauma you had happened, right? And at first, I would get really angry reflecting on, like, oh, wow, like, how could you have done X? So the therapy is very helpful to contextualize, to understand and to realize like, oh, I'm going to just do things differently. It's not a referendum on what they did, but it's hard not to compare and to want to do something differently.
Did that affect your relationship with your mother?
I think for a while I had a lot of rage. Yeah. For some of the choices that were made when I was young. And those were choices because of financial difficulty. Those were not, you know, just being left alone a lot and, you know, things that were sacrificed and things that weren't. I mean, my kids, like, I think a lot of parents have this conversation. I have this with other parents too. Like, how do we install some grit into these children? Because like their hands are so soft and by design, they're going to stay that way. Right. But, you know, not for me. Right. When you're 18, you're out of here. Right. Figure it out. And then, oh, why is this not an A? Why is Bartholomew before Denise? Right. And like, no, like that's just the way it is. Well, fix it. Work harder. Do some extra credit. Get, you know, a 5.0, a 4.0 is a scale. Get a 5. Why can't you get a 5? Mm-hmm. Right. So, but then not wanting to do that same thing, but also wanting to make sure that they do have that drive so that when they encounter adversity, it's not calling me or calling my husband or calling grandma. It's going to be, okay, how do I figure my way out of this, right? And you got to get some battle wounds along. You got to bounce a few checks and, you know, figure things out and get in trouble and then work your way out of it. But I don't know. I think that's like a challenge for this generation. I'm sure it is for you too.
Super hard, that piece, because a lot of the growth is being able to stick it out. Although a lot of the other growth is about feeling secure.
Right.
So this is a hard balance, especially, you know, in Asian households, which I'm going to generalize, but the generalization is pretty accurate. My father would always say, I'm not going to tell you I love you. We're not going to say we're proud of you. And, you know, they never did.
Wow.
But if you need me, I'm there. Mm. So what he was saying is like actions speak louder than words. So what they were communicating now as an adult looking at it was, you know, I don't want to say these things and so on because I want to just show you through my actions. And if I dig back a bit more into it, it's just whatever happened to them made it so tough, right? I remember my dad was sick for kind of a long time and he passed away in February, and about maybe a couple months before that, he pretty much could not move anymore. Mm. And he had 24-hour care along with my mother. And then myself, my sister, my brother, auntie, I mean, everybody was helping out for kind of a long time. He's had a high standard of care, but especially my mother. Mm-hmm. Like, even though he had caregivers, my mother was always there. Like, that was her first priority. He loved my mother. He loved us. I know that. He loved my mother. And it was her birthday last year. And I said, oh, Dad, why don't you give mom some appreciation and tell her thank you? And he's like, she already knows. And my daughter started getting in on it. She's like, come on, Gung Gung. Just tell Nana, you know, thank you and stuff. He's like, all right, she already knows. I told her, she knows. And said, Mom, do you know? She's a little bit hard of hearing. She's like, know what? He's like, Dad said that, you know, he's thankful for you. Do you know that? And she's like, Which is her way of saying, like, I mean, yeah, kind of. We were giving him a hard time. He's like, you know, you guys are always trying to mess with me. Just stop it already. So he got like all bent out of shape. And then I normally like to give him a hard time because that's just kind of how we, our relationship. But I remember meditating on it for quite a bit. And then I came back to him the next day and I said, you know, I know that I give you a really hard time on this. He goes, you always give me, I mean, he got triggered on. He's like, you always give me a hard time on this. You always, you know, I said, I meditated on this one. And I know you love Mom, I know you care. I know you're thankful. I know it. I said, so whatever happened to you that was so painful that you cannot actually express that, I was like, I'm sorry. And then everybody just started crying. Right? I'm sorry. Oh, my goodness. And then he instantly snapped out of it and was like, okay, something else. But that's kind of what I see, right? Which is what was so painful that you cannot express to people who are obviously like there and so on, something as simple as thank you or I love you. You know what I mean? I see these things so much more in my life. I said another one, like I was watching my oldest son kind of yell at my daughter and I was like, oh, you sound like your grandfather. My other son goes, no, he doesn't. He sounds like you.
Oh.
And I went, holy crap. you're right. Wow. Right? And that's where you see it going from one to the next to the next. And I went, oh my God. And one part of me is like justifying it, saying, well, that's just how it is and so on. And another one's like, dude, that's messed up. We need to do something on this. And it's the constant quandary that I have going on, you know, till kind of today, which is how do we intervene and stop the generational trauma kind of going through and continue the gifts that move through, right? Because you cannot take only the pain, right? I remember my son telling me something like, you know, it's your fault for this. And so I said, well, okay, I'll take that. Absolutely. I own that. I said, but I also own all the benefit part. So where's that? It's kind of stunned, right? You know, you wouldn't give me the responsibility for all of the pain. Mm. I'll take it. But I want the responsibility in all the other stuff too.
Right.
Right? And that gives a whole different perspective on kind of looking at this.
Do you very verbal about, like, do you tell your kids I love you all the time?
Yeah, I do. My parents, they just can't. It's just not in there. It's not in there. It's not that they don't. I mean, when you need them, they're there. They're there before you need them. Mm-hmm. My mother's an only child. And she said, you know, I grew up when my parents and everyone would say children are to be seen and not heard.
Right.
But when you think about that, that's what it is you're not seen and not heard. So you're not valued, right, is what the message is, right? Right? And the message growing up then becomes like, well, I'm not enough. I can never be enough. Right. So her solace is reading books. Like, she'll read books. Like, after my dad passed, all she just reads a ton of books. Right. And that's the messaging they come up with. Mm-hmm. Even though they want to, how do they go through that? Because it's so painful. Right. When the trauma, which is like not what happens to us, but what happens in us as a result of that. Mm-hmm. Right. Like what we can't let go of and what the wound that gets kind of stuck in there. Then, I mean, it's painful. Like, it feels like how it felt when it happened. Mm. Which is why you go, oh, that person's acting like a four-year-old. Well, the wounded four-year-old part is the one that's you're talking to right now.
Right.
Right? So, yeah.
It's why we all need loads and loads of therapy.
Well, the therapy I like, and I spend, as you know, I spend a lot of time in that area. Yeah. Actually, next week, I mean, I'm involved with, like, training therapists. Oh. But it's certain therapies I like better than others. Hmm. Just because there's a number of them that kind of pathologize things and say like, okay, this is what's wrong with you, and kind of exile parts of ourselves, which then is kind of like the lady that you're talking about, right? Where it's like all these things, nitpicking and so on. I guarantee you that same voice that she's doing to you, she does to herself.
Or to her kids.
Yeah.
Right.
And if you take that and you actually spend time with it and so on, There's a good chance it sounds like somebody that she knows.
Right.
Very right. Personally, right?
Right, which is why when you engage with that kind of person, you don't say, you're so wrong for saying that to me. You say, thank you for the feedback. Thanks for watching.
Well, you're in a hard position because you're in a position where you can't be like, hey, up yours.
Right, no, absolutely
because
not.
You can't do it, which would be really tough because then you feel, I don't see how you don't feel trapped.
You feel a little humiliated.
What's trapped because I can't move, right? I mean, right. At that point, then what do? You can dissociate a little bit. You can, you know what I mean?
You brush just take it off. Yeah.
Did you find that you would get kind of emotionally numb?
No, but I heard recently that the parts of our brains that remember the bad things are so much stronger because we're programmed to protect against fear, right?
Well, you got to survive.
Right. So when someone gives you a pat on the back, you don't remember it as much as if they like stab you in the chest, right? For obvious reasons, for survival. Mm-hmm. So even if you get a ton of positive feedback, it's like bullying. You experience that like really deeply. And it would take me a couple days to kind of get over that and not feel shaken and not sit there and deliver a newscast and think about that person watching you. So you take that one of two ways. I mean, you write back the gracious note and then you work that much harder, which is my instinct, right? Okay, how do I get that extra credit? How do I get at the top of the honor roll even if it seems impossible? But that's not healthy, right? So for me, it's better to just not have that job.
If you notice that strategy, because that's a strategy, right? The strategy is work super hard to avoid the pain.
Right. So when I was in college, I had this little placard on my, I had like a bulletin board with all the, you know, your class schedule, whatever. And it said, busy as a bee, results as sweet as honey. And I kept that all 4 years. And that's, I feel like, how I lived my life until I had kids. And then it was like, you know what? I'm not going to wait for those results because I might die swimming off Mahu Kona, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm going to be in the moment now. And I'm not living like that all the time. Like, I get just as stressed. I yell at my kids, get your shoes on. We got to go. Come on, come on. You know, like everybody else, you know, getting their kids off to school or whatever it is that you're doing. But I try to be a lot more present. The days are long, but the years are short. Don't you feel that? I feel that very intensely with children. You know, my son, he's 4 now. Like, his baby face is gone. Oh, it's so sad. And I'll say like, oh, where's my baby? And he said to me, Mommy, was I cuter when I was, you know, when I was 2? I said, no, I love you every phase. I do love every phase, but I do miss those cheeks. Like, I do.
I love every phase, but I love that one more.
Yeah. No. That was great.
Yeah. I love that one more. If you don't want to talk about this, you don't have to. But when you mention rage, how did that rage play into your life and how did it change?
So my parents got divorced when I was 5. We actually lived on Oahu at the time. And I learned how to fight from them, right? You pattern, like when you were talking about your kids, like you pattern yourselves after your parents. The divorce itself was harmonious. They came to a place where there was no fight over custody agreement, like none of that, right? That was very easy. But the lead up was very toxic. And so I like grew up with that feeling that at any point, the person that you're relating to can freak out and can yell and can be mean. Like, my parents did not fight kind. They fought mean, like with words, right? Not physical, but really mean to each other. And they were very young, right? So, you know, so I feel like I had a lot of that in me. But then I'm the kind of person who just takes it and takes it. And then when I get mad, I get really mad. And that's a really bad quality in a spouse and in a parent, right? You can't have that. So that's where the therapy comes in, figuring out, how can I be angry? Because that's a natural thing, but understanding what's behind that anger, whether it's disappointment or sadness, which I think is usually the core of what those emotions are. How do I express that to someone that I'm with so that they know that I'm upset, but not, you know, I don't want to fight like they fought, right? I really don't want to do that. But it took a lot of work to figure out how not to do that.
Was there an actual like healing moment between you and your mother?
I don't think there's a moment. I think that maybe you soften over time. My mother's super critical of me still. You know, she still watches every program and has comments. Oh, honey, you need a facial, right? I remember like during the pandemic, we stayed with her for a long time. And when we left, she handed over like couple hundred dollars and she's like, go get your teeth whitened, you're drinking too much coffee. Like, that's who she is at her core. I can get angry about that, or I can just take the money and spend it on whatever I want. And I think that's where I'm at. So I don't think there's like there's not some watershed, like you come to an understanding. But I mean, she has softened also with age, I think, and I have a lot more compassion for where she was coming from. And I also have an appreciation. It's a weird duality where you don't necessarily love the way you were parented or some of the choices that were made. I mean, and this is not to say that there weren't good things. Obviously, there were a lot of good things. It's like what you were talking about with your son. You're going to toss the bad. You also have to take credit for all the good. Like, I didn't get there by myself, right? All of these things that have happened in my life didn't happen in a vacuum. They're not just me. They're the accumulation of a lot of people putting in a lot of work to make things happen. But kind of getting to a place where you appreciate the good things too and not meeting everything. I'm never going to be good enough, so I'm not even going to try, you know?
So what would be a story of your mother that's like the most kind of tender and meaningful for you?
I mean, my mom, it's funny because she's not that sort of stereotypical Asian parent in that she says, I love you all the time, right? She gives me a lot of compliments. I think what's a turning point for us is she's always telling me to work less now, which is so weird. It's so weird. But she's always like, enjoy your life. take time. Don't work so hard. Go get another facial. Like, go get a massage. Like, it's very weird, right? But I think that also my stepfather's death probably had that impact on her too, that you kind of realize, like, oh, it's so short that you better enjoy it.
Do you know about her upbringing and so on that brings a lot of context to why?
Yeah, she grew up really poor, like post-war Korea. Her father died when she was a teenager. She didn't get to go to university because she was the girl. She has two brothers, so she worked so that they could go to college, but she couldn't, you know, that kind of like sexist paradigm that was the case at the time. And so, yeah, when I was growing up, this is why I'm a terrible cook. She would never let me in the kitchen. She would never let me do dishes. She would always say, study. It's all I ever wanted to do. All I ever wanted to do was read. Go read, right? So I excelled academically, not so much in the other respects. When Kent asked me to marry him, I didn't say this at the proposal, but in the lead up, I said, you know, if we're going to be together long term, you have to know that I don't cook and that I'm never going to have a flat stomach. So if you can like deal with those two things, we can be together. He's like, this is the most ridiculous conversation. Sure. Like, okay. Like, I can deal with those two things.
Wow. That's instant love.
Yeah. They can accept your tummy and that you're not going to cook for them. Great. Let's do it.
There's a saying from this book. I think I say this in like every episode, but it's by Resma Menakem. It's My Grandmother's Hands. It's how generational trauma moves through like the body. And he says that over time, trauma gets decontextualized, right? You forget about why and so on. So trauma decontextualized in a people looks like culture. And then trauma decontextualized in a family looks like family traits. And then trauma decontextualized in a person looks like a personality.
Wow.
And then I added my own, which was trauma decontextualized in a company looks like company culture. Mm-hmm. Right? But once you know like the context, then everything makes total sense.
Right.
Right? She can't go to school. That's all she ever wanted. She's going to
make it happen
mm-hmm. for you. Mm-hmm. Right? And then you are making it happen for the things that you didn't necessarily feel you got as a child with your kids. I do the same kind of for mine. I spent a massive amount of time in this kind of, you know, therapeutic healing realm where I thought initially I'm just going to spend time doing business stuff purely because I noticed the damage that I've done in my own kind of family. And my kids even noticed that. They're like, you're not as hard on, you know, Eliana as you were on us. I'm like, you know what? You're right. But there's nothing I can do about that now. Right. You know what I mean? Like, and the interesting thing is how that gets justified, because I said, well, would you have wanted it differently? And sometimes they'll be like, well, it did make me work harder in this and have to push for that and so on. I remember that in myself too, pushing that way because I feel like I'm not enough or whatever, and I have to push in this other way. So it makes me accomplish. There's nothing like shame to accomplish. There's nothing like that kind of energy that give you the energy to actually accomplish something. But then it becomes, well, if that stuff was all healed, then would I still accomplish, right? Like, would I still accomplish these things?
Right.
That's the kind of the question always.
Right. So my parents divorced when I was 5. And because they were, you know, hippies or whatever, they decided to let me choose the custody agreement. Terrible, terrible parenting choice. Terrible, right?
How old were you?
5. So, why would you do that? They wanted to empower me. Who do you want to live
with? Are you sure that they wanted to empower you?
I think they didn't want to make the choice.
Do you think that that's a cop-out?
100% cop-out. It's rebranded as, we wanted to give you the choice at 5.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So not wanting to hurt anyone's feelings, I said, well, I'll just live 1 year with one and 1 year with the other. So up until middle school was 2 years constant, and then high school was with my dad. But from then on, I switched schools every year. And my parents didn't have a lot of money. So my mom first lived in Kona, then she lived in Waikoloa, then she lived in Waimea, and now she lives in Hawaii. She like made the way up the Kohala coast, right? Or the Kona coast to Kohala. My dad lived between here and California. And, you know, he's a yoga teacher, so he's kind of nomadic too. So every year was a new school. Every year is a new set of people. Every year is having to be like, Hi, I'm Yunji. I have a really hard name, and this is my background, and here's where I'm from, and I have parents, and they're divorced. And so my mom was somewhat of a constant. Like, I was going to the same school, going back to the same elementary school, and then I stayed in the same middle school, and then I moved to the mainland for high school. And even at high school, she was like, well, you'll just go up there for 1 year and see. And I was like, you don't understand. And my parents, like, not being of this country, don't understand. I'm like, I have to have the same high school transcript. Like, once I go, I'm going, and I'm staying there. Right. And I didn't want to go at the time because you're in middle school. You don't want to go to high school somewhere else. You want to stay with your friends. Like, but I always say that was terrible. Right. It's terrible to always have to be new, but it's also super strengthening. Like, it helps me in my job. I can talk to anybody. I can go to anyone and introduce myself and make them feel comfortable because I know exactly what that feels like. But for my kids, I'm like, no, they're going to the same school. K through 12, not moving. We're going to stay in the same place to live. Like, we're not having any, like, no transient, like, none of that. I don't want them to ever feel like that. But then there's also, there's a value in being the new kid because you're going to be the new kid in some context. You're going to be the new employee or, you know, whatever it is. That has served me really well. But that one was really hard. I don't recommend it. Don't give your kids that choice.
So do you feel like you were a parentified child?
Oh, 100%. Yeah.
So that's why you are so capable to an extent?
I think so. I mean, I don't know if I'm so capable, but I'm able to figure things out. Yeah.
Because you had to.
Right. No choice. And that, I think that's for a lot of immigrant children. I don't think that's unique to me. I think that, you know, a lot of people, and even much more so, my parents both spoke English. Right. There are a lot of kids who have to interpret documents for their parents because their parents don't speak English or they, you know, whatever the host language is, whatever the country.
So are you, you bilingual or
I'm
trilingual?
I'm not. I wish I was. But my parents, because they spoke different languages, they just spoke English in common. And that's also why they ended up getting divorced, because when they met, they both like spoke broken English and then they got married. And I remember when I was very young, we had dictionaries in the house so they could figure out how to communicate with each other. And so like the better their English got, the worse their marriage got, right? Actually, when you don't speak the same language as someone, it's like watching TV on mute. You're projecting what you want them to be saying or what you think they mean or what they should mean. And then when you actually get to speak, then you realize that it's a bad match.
Is there a story behind your name?
Yeah, so my grandma's name is Ji Yun. So Yun means lotus, Ji means wisdom. So it's supposed to be like beautiful and smart together. And so my name is just her characters turned around. And then my daughter's middle name is Ji Yun.
Kind of fitting, huh?
I hope so.
Did you ever meet your grandmother?
Yeah, yeah. She died a couple years ago of dementia in South Korea. But yeah, I studied abroad when I was in college. So I lived in Korea for 6 months and I lived with her and my uncle. And that was also very healing. That was very healing for my mom because, you know, she left in her early 20s. And at the time, Korea was under martial law. So to leave the country, you had to marry another national and give away your nationality. So that was super painful because she couldn't go back to Korea for many years. You know, and I think for the person who leaves, they always feel kind of guilty. And she had a much better life in terms financially, at least, and always sending money back, like that kind of very traditional dynamic. So when I went back, I think a lot of healing happened.
Like, how does that healing happen?
Just having that relationship, I think, was very powerful for all of us. My Korean is terrible now, but it was pretty good then because none of them spoke English. And I was studying Korean like all day long for 6 months. So I wrote my mother like letters in Korean. And like she keeps those. She said they're so precious to her. Like that was super meaningful for her, which is funny because she didn't teach me to speak Korean growing up. And then I went to college, studied Korean, went abroad and like had that. And even though I don't barely speak Korean now, all that effort was worth it for like that, those moments, for those letters, for that experience, because it was like, and I got to understand her so much better. Because it's like, oh, these are the people you grew up around. Like, I understand why you're so hard charging, why it means so much, why the grades matter so much, why it's so important to be successful because you struggled so much, you know?
What was the most touching or meaningful experience you had in Korea?
I think just being with my grandma. We would go to the bathhouse a couple of days a week because in Korea, they have like, well, it depends on the house. Like the house my uncle lived in is kind of small and older. So they had like a bathroom, but you can't really take a shower in there. You can just kind of like rinse. Like, I don't know how to explain it. It's like a like a bucket and like a faucet. So to really wash yourself, you go to the bathhouse. So we would go to the bathhouse like every week, a couple times a week. And that was, you know, it's very, that's a very intimate thing.
It's like a Korean spa.
Yeah. So you scrub.
Or sauna, Korean sauna.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So there's a sauna. There's like, it's not as like elaborate as some of the ones, but the, just like the neighborhood bathhouse, because the whole neighborhood goes and washes there. I'm sure that's changing.
It's like public or
yeah,
you pay?
Yeah, it's public. Oh. You pay. Yeah, but a small fee. And that was another thing. My grandma thought it was like such a luxury to go. And I remember like I bought her like a pass. And so then we would go and she didn't have to pay for it. She was very into it. And this is my granddaughter. And then we'd go and then you scrub each other's back. Right. And that's like I don't know, that just that physical intimacy. Because my Korean was okay. And she spoke no English. So you're just relating on like, okay, wash my back. Like, you know, and that's very beautiful. It's very intimate.
How did she introduce you, your grandmother?
So this is my granddaughter.
Oh, this is not my granddaughter. She went to Yale. Not like that. Like, no. You know, because that's normal, right? Like, that's normal style. Like, my granddaughter, she went to Yale.
Oh, I don't know that meant anything to her at the time. That was a really beautiful experience. I'm so lucky to have had it.
You know, for the schools that you applied to for college, mm-hmm. you said there were 12. What were they?
Okay, so all the UCs. So that's like five or six there. Stanford, didn't get in. Swarthmore, waitlisted. Brown, I think I got waitlisted. I can't remember now. Wellesley, Yale, Harvard, rejected. And I feel like maybe there might have been an Amherst in there. I don't know. I'd have to go back and look. But all the UCs for sure. Swarthmore, I don't know why. I thought they had like a good political science. I don't remember. Like, it, you know. And I was really interested in studying politics at the time. I wasn't like looking for a broadcast journalism program. Or I wouldn't have picked Yale because Yale doesn't have one. So I did radio in college because they didn't have a TV station at the time. They have since obviously over time expanded, but they didn't then.
So you have any aspirations to go into politics?
No, because I hate asking people for money. So I think that part of the job, if campaigns are publicly financed, I think I would. I have a very close friend who's running for office right now in California. And, you know, it's not her fault. This is the second time she's run. She has to ask me for money. I know she hates doing it. And I'm happy to give her a little bit of money, right? And just so that all the folks out there know, I can't donate locally to campaigns. That's actually like legally for PBS, I cannot, because it's unethical, which my husband loves, because then he never has to donate to anyone, because he can't donate to anyone either. But because his campaign is out of state, it's a small assembly race, it's fine. But that whole dynamic, I know she hates asking me, and I don't mind that she does, but I would hate to be asking. Like even, you know, I serve on a board for Honolulu Theater for Youth, and we have to sell tables and do that kind of thing. I hate doing that. I love the organization. Like, I just don't like asking people for money.
Well, how does it work in your business now, though? Because you're a consultant. You have to go out and drum business.
I have to. Yeah, I hate that part. I love the content creation. I hate the business part. So I have a really good partner, Ryan Kalesuji, and he's much better at that side.
Well, so how did you guys end up partnering up?
So we worked together at KITV, and then it's actually kind of funny. I left KITV. He went to work for the governor, and because he had worked for David Ige when he was like in the ledge. And I remember him telling me, oh, David's going to run for governor. And I was like, oh, yeah, good luck with that. Like, you know, thinking, but he ended up, you know.
Well, why did you say that? Good luck with that.
Because I just, you know, David Ige, and he'll be the first to tell you, he's not the most dynamic speaker. He doesn't like command a room in the way that you think the person for running for governor would. But he is just a very, you know, reliable, seemingly honest. I mean, I assume he's honest person. No scandals in his administrations. Very steady hand. I mean, look at how he handled COVID. A lot of people disagree with it, but we have the lowest death rate for COVID in the country. We had some of the lowest infection rate. That also is due to our geography, right? But it's also because he was very, you know, he's very measured. He just didn't seem to me to have what I would imagine. He's not Gavin Newsom. Let's just say that, right? So when Ryan told me, oh yeah, David, and he's going to win. And I thought, yeah, right. And then I was totally wrong. But anyway, so Ryan's doing that and I have the baby and I'm kind of like not really working. So I said, you know, I really want to start doing Facebook live streams. Like, I think this is the next thing. Like, let's do that. So we would meet every Wednesday and just, I had like a public Facebook page and we would do like this thing that we called hashtag Hawaii, which is now the name of our company. And we would just choose a restaurant or a place to broadcast from. And we would just talk story for a half an hour every week and kind of work that muscle of doing like a live show online. And And I ended up getting an opportunity with the paper to do some work, and I needed a partner. So I was like, hey, we've been doing this thing anyway, let's do it. And then a couple of years later, we launched Spotlight during the pandemic. And now, you know, we've been working together for years and years. And it's great. He's from Big Island also. He's from the Hilo side. He's like Kent in that he's super reliable, humble guy. I trust him 100%. You know, he's everything you'd want in a business partner.
If you could remember one story involving Ryan that is like meaningful to you, what would it be?
I mean, he just is so good with rolling with it. The worst things can be happening. And he has humor. He has grace. He's okay with whatever happens. Like we were interviewing John Wayhe and Governor Abercrombie for our show. And Governor Abercrombie doesn't have Facebook, and his wife won't let him have Facebook. And we needed him to log in through this thing called StreamYard, which requires that you have a Facebook page. So I'm on the phone with the governor's wife, and she's like, how can the largest newspaper in the state require Facebook? Like, blah, blah, blah. She's like really pissed. And, you know, the time is ticking and we have to hit at this time. And I'm like, we have to do this interview. So this is like so ridiculous. So I call him on FaceTime, and then we do the interview by me holding up the phone to the camera every time he wants to talk. And he is a verbose speaker, right? He has a lot to say. So he's going on. And then I'm like trying to kind of cut him off, but like not, it was like, you know, and then Ryan's just rolling with it and we're rolling with it. And John Wayhe is just like laughing it up and making fun. It was great. It was, you know, but that's what I mean. Like a lot of people I think would panic in that situation, and Ryan does not.
So in all of your interviews you've ever done, who was the most memorable for you and why?
There was a boy, his name is Brian Jackson. So ABC used to do this thing called Person of the Week. So I read about him in a magazine, and it's a super sad story. His mother got pregnant. His father didn't want to be born. They were just casually dating. So they were never married, but she went ahead and had him. And they had some kind of joint custody, not full custody, but some days he would watch him. And his father was a phlebotomist, right? So that's someone who deals with blood. Unbeknownst to the family, his father knowingly injected him with HIV when he was 6 months old. So, I mean, think about the kind of person who would do that. It's like horrible. It, you know, this is like in the 90s, late 80s, early 90s. Not a lot is known about AIDS. First of all, what was unknown at the time, his father thought probably that he would die right away. It takes years for him to develop full-blown AIDS. Meanwhile, he's sick as a little kid. They can't figure out what's wrong with him. Nobody thinks to test a little kid for HIV. Finally, they figure it out. And by the time they figure it out, he has full-blown AIDS. He had all these treatments. He had tremendous hearing loss, so he's deaf now. But he had overcome all of this, and he was working as a counselor for kids at a camp. He was going to college and working as a counselor for kids with terminal illness to try to help them. And he hadn't forgiven his father. His father went to jail. This all got figured out. Took years. In the meantime, when he's a little kid, when this is revealed, families don't want him in their school. I mean, it's a very different time, right? There's all, you can get it from a toilet seat, all that kind of thinking. And he has to take all that. And because of the treatments that he got, them not knowing what he had his hearing loss. So he suffers like tremendously. His father ends up going to jail. His father was coming up for parole, which is why we did this story, and really highlighting him as the person of the week. I mean, like, gosh, person of the year. Like, can you imagine overcoming that kind of adversity? And then he's working at a camp for kids with terminal illness and with HIV. I just remember meeting this young person and just being so just humbled by that interview, you know? I mean, I've interviewed presidents and first ladies and all of that, but I think like this young man, like that will stay with me forever.
What's the most important takeaway from that?
That you can overcome anything. I mean, here he is. He's a teenager. He's going to college. He's helping other kids. You know, he's in a relationship. All of these things, like he is living his life. And the other thing that struck me was that, you know, the question, oh, well, has he forgiven his dad? No. And that's okay, too. You don't always have to forgive the people who hurt you. You know, I think that there is this thing in our culture. You don't have to, you know, harbor deep rage, right? Because that's unhealthy for you. But forgiveness is a gift, and you don't have to give that to everybody, right? So that also is, I think, kind of meaningful.
What was the most surprising interview you've done? Surprising where you would have picked up the phone after and called your friend and be like, oh my gosh, this happened.
I remember I went to LA once and I interviewed Ricky Lake about home birth. And she was like so real and down to earth. And I remember calling my girlfriend and be like, I was in Ricky Lake's house. You know, Hairspray was like a big movie when we were growing up, right? So I was in Ricky, and then watching the Ricky Lake show. So that's like celebrity, but that's not really like surprising.
Or how about if you could only remember one interview from every single interview you ever had?
Okay.
Which one would it be and why? Like if you were going to have amnesia tomorrow, you can only remember one for whatever reason it is. Which one would you remember?
Okay, I remember... like I went to Mexico City with the first lady, with Michelle Obama, because she was going there on like a goodwill tour. And you have to remember that when Michelle Obama became first lady, like it's hard to tap into that now, but there was such an allure around this family, right? They were the first young family. First of all, they were the first African Americans, right? They were young. Their kids were little. She was very fashion forward. She wore J. Crew at the inauguration. She, you know, when she walked down Pennsylvania Avenue and she was wearing this like green outfit and there was like J. Crew in there, she, for her official photo, was sleeveless. And this was like a scandal that she would like show her arms. But my goodness, she was like buff and strong. And she had this White House garden and she was like all of these things. Also, she went to Princeton and she was a lawyer. Like she was just so hard charging. I also think like the women who came before that, I think, you know, Hillary Clinton really changed that office and really made it something in a way that it wasn't, you weren't just the wife, you were also kind of an advisor and a partner. And Barack Obama always said that about Michelle Obama. And so she had her own initiatives in a way that, you know, Hillary Clinton allowed for that. A lot of people pushed back from that, right? Because she had taken on healthcare and there was a lot of bad feelings about the way that had gone. But anyway, so here's Michelle Obama and she's like larger than life. And I just remember, you know, going to Mexico City and seeing all these children that were just like enamored with her. Like she was the biggest rock star they'd ever seen. And then sitting down and interviewing her, and the way those interviews work, it's like a round robin. The person sits down and ABC does an interview, CBS does an interview, NBC does an interview. Like we all get a crack, right? And I was last. And then we had to drive across town and like go do a live shot and like we made our deadline. And just that whole experience, that whole trip, and that, you know, getting to sit down with her and ask her questions and then making deadline and being in this beautiful city. I just remember feeling like, wow, like I really made it. This is what this is about. And the network had hired me a driver and he took me all around the city. And I just felt so like some of that, like her energy, I felt like rubbed off on me. I didn't feel like I was Michelle Obama, but I felt that kind of like, I'm a woman in control of my career. Like here I am in this amazing city, like doing this work that I love. And like, I just felt so on top of the world in that moment. Like that kind of feeling, it wasn't the content of the conversation. It was just the feeling of that whole experience that I think I'll remember forever.
So with that, what was the most unique or surprising thing about her that you weren't expecting?
You know, she's just so honest. She had a quote recently where she said, you can have it all, but you can't have it all at once. And I think about that all the time because I think that's exactly how I'm living, right? I had a really big career moment for myself. Like all the things I wanted to do, I did it, right? And now I feel like I have like another life, like that was another person, you know, and then now I have this other life. And so I am having it all, but it's not all at the same time. It's too much for one person. It's just not going to happen. As a woman, it's not going to happen. You know, I said to my husband recently, we were talking about some of the executives in our community. I said, gosh, I really wish there were more women. Like, why are there not more women in these positions, right? And he said, well, because they all get sidelined by having kids. Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right. We got to figure that out. I don't know how we figure that out. I don't know. Maybe the careers are longer so you can have these iterations. But yeah, I mean, you can have it all, just not at the same time.
On that piece where there's less women in like the highest levels of leadership, right? I have this discussion with my wife kind of often because my wife, who has, you know, their doctorate, she, you know, she's all kinds of stuff, runs our companies on things, also teaches. And people ask, well, you should have been a principal or you should have done this and these other things. And she would always wrestle with that, like, oh, I should have done these things. I maybe I should have been a doctor. And maybe I, you know, I said, have you ever thought about that, like your life that you have lived is the pinnacle of what a lot of other women would say, I wish I had, I was able to do,
right?
You know, spend time with your children, be there in a meaningful way for your family, do these other things, you know? So it's always kind of these, that duality, right? And I think the hardest thing when I observe that is just to be okay with it.
Yeah.
And you don't have to be someone else's kind of opinion of yourself.
That's very wise. Yeah. Yeah. And that's what I was talking about, having those conversations at Long's. What are you doing now? You know, and feeling like, oh, I don't have to explain. Mm-hmm. Right. I remember my daughter, you know, for pickup, like especially the first year, less so now as she gets older, but still, but you know, I would drive up to pick her up and she would see me and her face would light up, right? The recognition, like, and I remember saying to my therapist, like, gosh, I love this moment and I wouldn't want to cede it to anyone else. And she said, well, Yenji, that moment wouldn't happen with someone else. She's like, if someone else is picking her up, she's like, there are things happening in her brain because she's your child and you have this connection. And so she has this feeling, this recognition, like this, like, I mean, it's not like, ah, but there is like this little like love, right? That kind of explodes just for a second. She wouldn't have that with someone else. She has it because you're the one in the car coming to get her and she sees you and that recognition happens and things are happening in her brain. I thought, oh, wow, that's pretty amazing. And I didn't have that, right? Because my parents were always working. Nobody was picking me up. Mm-hmm. No one was like, I mean, half the time no one was coming to school conferences. Like people were working and they were busy and parents were in other states and that's just the way it was. So that's why, you know, I'm lucky that I get to be the one in that pickup line. I tell myself that when I'm in traffic, right? This is a blessing.
If you were going to interview yourself.
Okay.
But you only could ask yourself like two or three questions. Oh, what geez. Would you ask yourself?
That's a tough one. I think it's like, what's next, right? Which I don't know. So that's a bad question. But for me, I mean, the answer to that question is, I'm not at a place anymore where I'm trying to get to the next rung. And that is way different for me. That is still a struggle. It's like what you were talking about with your wife, where, you know, especially academically, right? The metrics are super clear. I'm going to go here. I'm going to get this SAT score. And then I'm going to go to this college. And then I'm going to go to this graduate school. And then I'm going to get this job. And then I'm going to do, you know, like, it's very linear. Or I'm going to be a reporter in this market. And then I'm going to go to network. And then I'm going to be an anchor. And then I'll have my own show. And, you know, I'll be Oprah, right? There's no path anymore. It's just sort of like the branches of a tree where I've gotten off the path and now it's sort of like whatever's going to happen. So that is very liberating. Maybe that goes back to your authenticity question about what that looks like. It's like being okay with not necessarily that you're like a passenger on a bus. You're still driving, right? You're still climbing the ladder. It's just that the ladder's not linear anymore. It's kind of more climbing a tree.
I just want to acknowledge you and just say that you, for the longest time that I've known you, for at least it seems like 10 years mm-hmm. now, right? And you would always give your time to volunteer for the community events that we were doing. You would never charge us. You would just be so gracious. You always bring what I feel is like your true self. There's no real airs around you. So I just wanted to appreciate that.
And thank you.
Say thank you for coming on the show today.
Oh, thank you for having me. I hope that, you know, I said something that is useful to someone. And thank you for giving me the space to talk because no one ever asked me questions. So it's nice to be asked.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
If you resonate with Greater Good Radio, please join our community at www.greatergoodradio.com where you can get access to exclusive content and offerings. Hope to see you soon.